crime and the background for during this paper. So, and I'll just read it. Ever since Rachel Carson warned of the prospect of a silent spring, environmentalists and concerned citizens have been listening carefully and often anxiously to birds. This paper is about the process of listening and the responses to what is heard and not heard. I use the concept of the Anthropocene, the recently designated geological epoch in which human activity has become the central earth-shaping force, it's argued, to think through these anxieties. The Anthropocene is a relatively new idea from around about the turn of the century and since then. Debates about when, so there's the idea that we are now in a new geological epoch in which humans are the primary earth-shaping force, and exactly when we, well, whether we agree with it, first of all, but whether we, when we start the Anthropocene is a subject of debate. It's perhaps most often thought to begin with the sort of onset of industrialization, and I sort of take it as starting around about then, but that's a debatable point. But anyway, what is it like to listen to birds in the Anthropocene? How is our response to what we hear influenced by the understanding that the Anthropocene brings, that humans have profoundly influenced the mix of sounds that can be heard? And Rachel Carson found one of the great environmentalist symbols in Silent Spring. What if spring wasn't heralded by the sound of singing birds? Why, she asked, is the modern world moving rapidly, in some cases, into such a state? She actually writes rather little about birdsong itself, but then she didn't need to. She was pointing to something so fundamental and familiar that the meaning of its loss would be both shocking and immediately understood. Silent Spring was so powerful an idea because it quite literally brought home to people what damage was being caused to ecosystems by humans. This damage wasn't happening far away, it was having quite tangible and deleterious effects on many people's everyday experiences. The post-war great acceleration, though documented often in the Anthropocene studies, which Carson was amongst the first herself to document, had its symbol in the loss of something meaningful and beautiful, but also common enough to be taken for granted. Listening to birds, for Carson, was no longer something that could be thought of as straightforward or inevitable. Carson quotes a woman from Alabama writing about the effects of a massive spraying program to control fire ants. Our place has been a veritable bird sanctuary for over half a century. Last July, we all remarked there are more birds than ever. Then suddenly, in the second week of August, they all disappeared. There was not a sound of the song of a bird. It was eerie, terrifying. What was man doing to our perfect and beautiful world? Finally, 5 months later, a blue jay appeared, and a wren. Life in such a perfect world was thus accompanied by the presence of birds at present night, presence made manifest in their songs. When familiar companions no longer accompanied, the shock was terrifying. Harmony and balance was a state that Carson thought had been lost in the modern world. She began Silent Spring with this nostalgic sentence. There was once a town in the heart of America where all life seemed to live in harmony with its surroundings. Perhaps this harmony was not just something that could be seen or measured, but that could also be heard. This is a point argued by the musician and scientist Bernie Krauser, most notably in his 2012 book, Great Animal Orchestra. Krauser's argument is that places have evolved their own ecology of sounds, and that in a natural environment, the sounds will tend to fit together rather than disrupting or competing with one another. He begins his book by speculatively describing the soundscape of the American plains 16,000 years ago and prior to the arrival of humans in North America. An array of now extinct mammals, more familiar birds, insects, and amphibians fill the air with their sounds. But despite this complex mix of sound, each animal is able to make itself heard. Inspired by Murray Schafer's soundscape approach, Krauser argues that this is because each species has a sound that occupies a distinct bandwidth and so can exist in harmony with other sounds that tend to occur around it, be they from other species or from physical factors such as running water. This is, he writes, the tuning of the great animal orchestra. Krauser divides up sound into three categories. First is the geophony, that is sound made by the physical environment, such as waves, wind, or rain. Second is biophony, which consists of sounds made by animals, plants, and other organisms. Finally, there is the anthropophony, or human-generated sounds. And whilst this classification is ostensibly based on the origins of the sounds rather than what they actually sound like, Krauser emphasizes the evolutionary emergence of the different types of sound, arguing that, quote, the sounds of geophony were the first sounds on Earth, and this element of the soundscape is the context in which animal voices and even important aspects of human sonic culture emerged, end of quote. So here we have a sense of the sounds of the world developing in relation through the geological eras and into the present day. The different types of sound that Krauser outlines might themselves be regarded as sonic epochs, in which a particular category of sound emerged or tended to predominate. As such, Krauser is arguing that we have now entered the epoch of anthropophony, and that human sounds are drowning out the biophony and geophony in many parts of the world. The Anthropocene has also ushered in a new kind of anthropophony, at least if we date it from the big onset of industrialization, with the sounds of industry, machinery, combustion engines, and electronic amplification being a rather different and more disruptive type of human-induced sounds than those that would have predominated in the pre-industrial era. As such, I would argue that one can differentiate between pre- and post-Anthropocene anthropophony, the former tending to integrate more closely with other sounds and the latter often disrupting or dominating them. Indeed, Krauser's main concern is not with the effects of anthropophony in general, but the effects of what he calls electromechanical sounds. Problematic sounds don't so much originate in human bodies themselves, but in Anthropocene technologies used by humans. Humans, Krauser argues, are not just having an effect on the biophony by drowning out the sounds of other species with their own, but also by disrupting the ecosystems of species. Here his concerns are clearly aligned with those of Carson, but he's not just concerned with the loss of sounds, but with the disruption to the harmonious sonic ecosystem. It's not just a spring of silence that is a worry, but one of disharmony. Humans have effects on other sounds, not just through their own sounds, but through their effects on habitats. These changes don't necessarily just reduce the number of sounds, but they tend to cause disruption to the relative harmony of the soundscape. When a biome is compromised, spectrograms will lose both. I'm quoting Krauser here. When a biome is compromised, spectrograms will lose both their density and diversity, along with the clear bandwidth discrimination among voices that is otherwise visible in non-stressed habitat graphic displays. Biophonies from stressed, endangered, or altered biomes tend to show little organizational structure. When he talks about spectrograms, he's talking about instruments for plotting frequency against time, which can show the distribution of different sounds. And I'm broadly in agreement with Krauser's arguments about how to understand sounds, particularly his emphasis on considering sounds within the context of the environments in which they emerge, a point often forgotten in the analysis of bird sounds by scientists and other scholars who take recorded sounds as discrete, decontextualized objects. I also appreciate his relational definition of noise, and I quote, "I think of noise as an acoustic event that clashes with expectation. Loud, heavy metal music in an intimate restaurant is noise. A straight piping motorcycle gunning its way through the delicate landscape of Yosemite Valley shatters the numinous experience of both visitors and animals." End quote. And noise is thus a conflict that emerges from perceived disjunctions of one set of sounds and another, or between one aspect of the world is experienced and another. It is dissonance rather than resonance, and Krauser's argument is that dissonance and noise has increased greatly to the detriment of the biophony and to human well-being. As sounds are the products of activities, this also points to increasing dissonance between human activities more generally and the activities of other species in our environment. Whilst I agree with much of Krause's approach, I'm sometimes troubled, though, by the idealization of pristine wilderness. Perhaps a very American kind of way of thinking. And although Krause's approach to wilderness is sometimes nuanced, it's often quite essentialized. The world as it should sound for Krause is not just pre-Anthropocene, like the rural idyll Carson draws on, but pre-human, like the early North American scene he begins his book with. It is a world not of companion species, but of strangers. How then might one listen to birds in the Anthropocene, in a world in which humans are not just present, but dominant and noisy, and in which our activities are often dissonant with those of other species? I found myself pondering this question whilst writing this paper, as I listened to birds in the, to me, unfamiliar soundings of the surroundings of the Australian bush, and that's what you can hear, in case you're wondering. Certainly there is abundant life here, a constant twitter of fairy wrens, thornbills and red-brow finches, the chirps of a Jackie Winter or a grey shrike thrush, a garrulous cry from a kookaburra or a currawong, the eerie calls of magpies and ravens, the distant squawks of a flock of cockatoos, which you can hear at the moment, and the agitated bleating of masked lapwings. What do these sounds tell me about the place where I am? At times it seems chaotic, with a whole range of disparate and similar sounds competing with one another. It's certainly hard to know how a flock of cockatoos might fit harmoniously into any sort of animal orchestra. But I am unusually in a place where birds, together with a few insects and amphibians, are almost all I can hear. If this place sounds of anything, it sounds of its birds. It's far from silent or even quiet, but does seem to have what Krause calls tranquility. Silence, he argues, is not a desirable state, but quite disorienting. In silence, as Carson probably realized, it is hard to find a sense of place. Tranquility, on the other hand, is a state between noise and silence, in which a kind of endorphin-rich serenity is attained. In my research for the Listening to Birds project, an anthropological study of bird sounds, or people's relations with birds through sound, I received many stories from people narrating their own experiences. That's an aeroplane. Many of those are tinged with the sorts of Anthropocene anxieties that I've been describing and that I've experienced myself. These narratives were mainly received from the UK, but they also came from other parts of the English-speaking world, including Australia and New Zealand. What's most striking about most of the stories is that they concern listening to birds in familiar places around where people live. These are stories about birds that live alongside people that inhabit their gardens and towns. These are not stories of distant soundscapes in remote and wild places, but of companion species that make their own places through song in the places that people make. This is not to say that all is stable and unproblematic, as many narratives describe changes that have taken place through people's lives. A respondent from Northern England writes, and I quote, "I grew up in a suburban area of a northern industrial town and was used to seeing lapwings flitting away across the fields, pee-witting as they did so. I haven't seen a lapwing anywhere near the area for years now, and it saddens me to think that my daughters won't get that simple joy of seeing and hearing something otherworldly on their doorstep." In this example, an integral sight and sound of the rural-urban fringe has disappeared, probably because of the changes wrought by modern agriculture. In other cases, new birds have moved in, like the ringnet parakeets, that now add colour and sometimes unharmonious sound to the southeastern England, to the southeastern suburbs of England. A respondent from Surrey writes, and I quote, "Over the last year or so, I started hearing strange squawking in my garden. Normally, the bird songs are of the usual garden variety, so this was interesting. It turns out that we have ringnet parakeets living in the area, and it was them creating the squawks and screeches. Now I listen out for them, as it's lovely to see the bright green parakeets flying around and terrorizing the local wood pigeons. I've put out some fat and seed balls to attract them and all the other little birds in the area, so I can photograph them from my window, as no one really believes I have parakeets living nearby." Quote. The ordinary suburban lives of the home counties are enlivened by these exotic birds. terrorizing the wood pigeons and contrasting with bird songs of the usual garden variety. Sometimes the apparent stability and quietude of suburbia needs something to shake it up. But whether these stories concern disappearing species or incoming exotics, they speak of the sorts of connections with place that people make through bird sounds, of how places sound and how people would like them to sound. There are also connections made between bird sounds and a sense of time and season. There's nothing new or surprising about this. Indeed, ethnographic work by authors such as Stephen Fell, Greg Forth, and Theodore Levin shows that many peoples understand seasons in relation to the sounds of birds, even moving their settlement or planting crops in response to the arrival and sounding of particular species. Rachel Carson clearly understood this connection and its power. Indeed, her book might better have been called Silenced Spring. Spring as a period on the calendar wouldn't necessarily be silent without the birds, but it wouldn't really have been spring either. Birdsong doesn't simply herald the spring, in an important sense, it is spring. And the activities of birds are widely understood to resonate with the rhythms of time and season and the rhythms of human activity, and through their sounds, birds make their activity audible. Following from this understanding, many of my respondents expressed feelings of well-being in response to hearing birds, and this seems most apparent when people's lives also resonate with these rhythms, as Rob from Droitwich wrote, and I quote, "As a farmer, I'm up well before dawn at this time of year, but even now there are birds singing in the morning. I heard my first dunnock yesterday. They've already started pairing up, and the little owls have been amusing us with their bright chirrups every evening and morning. They certainly brighten up the dark mornings and evenings. As we move into spring, I'm lucky enough to hear the dawn chorus every day, and it does give me a real lift. Lambing time can be magical when you see newborn lambs taking their first steps to a sometimes deafening suite of blackcaps, robins, chiffchaffs, willow warblers, and the rest. If you can't appreciate that, then there's something seriously wrong with you." When people like Rob attend to the activities of birds, as they go about their lives, they are given, as you put it, a real lift. This lift, I argue, stems from a sense of resonance that comes from this sympathetic attention to the activities of other beings around us. The sort of attunement of activities that Rob describes resonates, but it also requires that he be sensitive to the lives of those around him. The resonance that my respondents described in relation to the sounds of birds is, I think, an emergent and experiential aesthetics, and one that draws lives and activities together. Resonance is integral to how people idealize experience and how they want their relations with a place to be. This desire for resonance is not just about how things sound, but about fitting in with the activities of birds. Listening to birds, for my respondents, is not simply about apprehending the sound, but about trying to understand how that sound relates to their own activities, the places they find themselves in, and the temporalities of those places. But how do people respond when their activities seem out of sync with the activities of birds? A respondent from London illustrates this well. I quote, "Personally, I prefer going to bed late and waking up late than going to bed early and waking up early. Sometimes I can take this to the extreme and stay up to the early hours of the morning till around the time normal, well-adjusted people wake up. At these wake-up times, though, birdsong is never far away. Through all the hours of total silence outside the house, to suddenly hear birds singing makes me remember that I'm awake when I should be in bed, and therefore makes me feel guilty. So usually, if I hear the first birdsong of the morning, I go to bed." And in this sort of self-deprecating account, there's an understanding that the birds' rhythms are somehow better than the writer's own rhythms, and that when the dissonance is revealed through sound, some sort of compromise with the idealized rhythms of birds and with normal, well-adjusted people is necessary. And whilst the rhythms of birds can be understood to be better adjusted and more natural than many human rhythms, there are occasions when birds give voice at inappropriate times. So Bernadette from Twickenham wrote, and I quote, "I live right by the railway station at Fulwell. When they were doing maintenance work one night at about 1 a.m, they were using floodlights and making a lot of noise. The birds started singing until there was a full dawn chorus. How confusing for them." End quote. Here it's the activities of humans that are confusing the birds. birds are understood to be highly responsive to changes in light levels. A dawn chorus in the middle of the night is explained through the ability of humans to influence the natural cycles of light and darkness. And these two examples of dissonance are not so disturbing, but more troubling instances arise from changes in human situations and changing bird populations and movements. When people move to other countries, they often find the different bird sounds they encounter to be unsettling, to precipitate a sense that they don't belong and that their activities no longer resonate with the right kind of bird sound. Even without moving, changes in local bird populations and the loss of species in their sounds can foster a sense of unease. But here instead, I prefer to tell a story that is about our ongoing and often fruitful with fruitful relations with birds and the sounds they make. These lives are ones that people often hope to resonate with, that is, to attend to them in a way that is ethical, that is aesthetic. To quote Donna Haraway, all ethical relating within or between species is knit from the silk-strong thread of ongoing alertness to otherness in relation. The ongoing alertness to the sounds of birds that my respondents told me about is just this kind of ethical relating. Listening to birds is one of our most formative experiences of concern for non-humans. Unlike Krauser, I prefer, though, to emphasize that listening to birds in the Anthropocene should not encourage a separation of human activities from those of birds, but instead on developing relations of companionship through listening. I propose not a narrative of encroaching loss and the ever-present threat that humans pose to non-humans, but one of enskillment of how we learn to listen to birds and the rest of the world, and how we learn to make ourselves at home.